On this Labor Day weekend, I keep going back, in my own mind, to some of the most moving conversations I've ever heard about work, recorded by the late journalist Studs Terkel. Like this one, with labor leader Cesar Chavez.
I went to something like 37 schools and was able to complete through the 7th grade and the beginning of the 8th grade. You know, there's schools we went to and they wouldn't take us in because we happen to be of a different color, you know. Schools that we went to were segregated three ways. Mexicans on one school, Negroes on the other one, and the Anglos on the other one. Days that we couldn't go to school because we didn't have shoes, or days we couldn't go to school because we just didn't have anything to eat.
You know, I'm thinking as we hear Cesar Chavez talk, we speak of two aspects of our country, one we know about and we don't know about at all, the deprivations of the people, in this case, the Mexican-Americans of the Southwest. And Woody Guthrie, as you know, Woody does Dust Bowl ballads, and one of the songs is Pastures of Plenty.
Pastures of Plenty from dry deserts around.
On the edge of your city, you'll see us, and then we come with the dust and we go with the wind.
On the edge of your city, see me, and then I come with the dust and I'm gone with the wind.
You weren't even getting minimum wages for a while, isn't it?
Well, it's a very sad thing that those who harvest the food don't have food themselves. We've been in the struggle now for 5 years. It'll be 5 years next month. So we have people working now at $2 an hour and with some very important gains. The most important thing is that at long last, there's that dignity that's been returned to us. They've seen some victories. They have courage. And it's a movement.
California, Arizona, I've worked on your program.
A man's sense of personal worth. I mean, for all these years, I suppose, with migrant farm workers, Mexicans, minority groups, you feel you're nobody. You're told you're nobody.
Then northward up to Oregon, gather your hops.
Suddenly the recognition that there's something you can do. You are somebody.
Imagine a group of workers who are working with the same employer for, say, 12 years.
Dug the beets from your ground. I've cut the grapes from the vine.
The strike is won, and then they go in and they sit on a table right across from him. And for the very first time, meet as man to man.
To set on your table your light sparkling wine.
Great feeling.
It affects every aspect of life.
Every area.
A sense of personal worth.
Studs Terkel, talking with labor leader Cesar Chavez, who founded what is now known as the United Farm Workers of America. So the labor movement and labor unions have had a tough time in recent years. But there are still new ideas, new ways of thinking about how to create truly democratic workspaces. A couple of years ago, Nikki Okuk started a tire recycling company in Los Angeles. RCO Tires is run along the lines of a worker-owned cooperative. Its employees are people who would ordinarily have a hard time finding any job. Nikki told Shannon Henry Kleiber she got the idea for it when she was working on her business degree at MIT.
Yeah, it's so funny. I think places like MIT, when you take these courses, Dr. Doom comes in and gives you the climate model about how everything's going to go in the next 50 years. Sometimes you can get inspired to think, I could fix this. I could do something. So I said, oh, yeah, I'm just going to go, you know, save the world. I was looking at plastics recycling, bottle recycling, and then finally tire recycling, and decided that was going to be it. And I knew if I was going to build a business, it had to be in my hometown, in my hood.
You're from Compton?
South Central. I mean, Los Angeles.
And so who are your workers and how did they come to RCO?
There was an article in LA Weekly that said that this guy had lost his job because he was a well-known graffiti artist and he'd already served 8 years or something in prison for his art. And I just sort of called out of the blue and I said, you know, if this guy's looking for a job, it's hard, physical, dirty work, but here's what we're doing. You know, we're picking up tires and we're recycling them. So Brian came on board and he's been with us ever since. We are now also now married with a child.
Oh, great.
A lot of the guys came to us out of that type of referral system because people who are formerly incarcerated and have trouble finding employment are very often talking to each other saying, oh, I heard about this place, RCO Tires, they're around the corner. You know, it's hard work, but it's a union job and they hire people who have records.
So tell me, what is a worker-owned cooperative? Give me an example of someone who did something with a worker cooperative that they might not have had the opportunity to do if they're just working for a regular company, a regular CEO.
Well, the dynamics of promotions or taking on more responsibility is interesting. If I were to look at a similar company of a similar size, typically they would have promoted, you know, whoever they thought was their most trustworthy or hardest worker, or very often people are promoted because they can kiss up or there's nepotism involved, or people are brought in from the outside. Inside of RCO, what we did is we just sort of all sat down, a dozen guys in the break room at work, and we talked about it and said, you know, we're going to need somebody to take the lead on the second shift. And honestly, at first, everybody said that they didn't want to do it because they didn't want to be put into a dynamic in which they would be in charge of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And we discussed the options. If we can't choose somebody amongst ourselves, amongst each other, then we'd have to go hire somebody outside. And immediately at that, all all 12 guys said, oh, no, no, we can't do that. We can't do that. We're going to have to figure it out. And they did. They sort of went around the room and asked who was going to step up. And finally, somebody who was very reluctant and didn't want to was nominated and assented and became our next lead.
How's that working out?
Pretty well. He's good at his job.
So as I look around, there's so many stories of workers barely getting by, working several shifts, sometimes working meaningless jobs. There's so many ways in our country that work doesn't seem to be working for people. What are the solutions that you're seeing?
So when I started RCO, I remember that I was so focused on the environmental metrics, right? Every week and month, I would say to myself, oh, we diverted this many thousands of pounds of rubber from landfills. We diverted this many gallons of oil and by manufacturing them into new products. And I'd sort of go to the break room and I'd tell the guys these things because those were the numbers that I was very proud of. And then at another meeting, absolutely none of them cared about any of the environmental metrics.
So interesting. Yeah.
All they kept saying was, one, we're really proud to work at a company that's owned by a Black woman. Sorry, I just got teary.
Oh, they're finding meaning in you.
They take a lot of pride in putting on their uniform, going out in the truck, performing the job well, and then having our customers be impressed by them and thank them for their work. A lot of the guys said that they had not had jobs like that before. You know, what work they had had was gig day labor for cash here and there. Very often, I think, two people come out of jail and they end up working for these staffing companies that charge the companies that they're working for, you know, $20, $30 an hour, but then only pay minimum wage. And these guys get bounced around and bounced around and bounced around, and they're treated as incredibly disposable.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things they kept mentioning was they felt indispensable. They felt like they were really needed, and they appreciated that feeling of being a part of something. They just said all sorts of incredible things that I wasn't expecting.
I'm picturing your break room. You've mentioned the break room. What happens there? I'm kind of picturing this group of people together talking about all kinds of things. What's it like?
We eat a lot of tacos.
Yeah, that sounds good.
The other thing I think that happens a lot in the break room, interestingly, now that you ask me, is compassion. Anybody who's ever been poor knows that this is for sure true, right? Like being poor takes a lot of work because crazy things happen. You know, you might be late on a bill and your light bill gets cut off, or, you know, you got a ticket, but you didn't have the money to pay it at the time. So now you got to go down to the courthouse, or car maintenance is let go. And so then your car breaks down and your wife's trying to pick up the kids from school, or just tons of things go wrong all the time, which means that people miss work. So we get to our break room at 7 a.m. every morning, and we sort of look around and we have to ask ourselves, okay, well, who's here? Who are we missing today because of one of these crazy things that just always happens when you don't have enough money to cover all your bases.
It's like triage.
Yeah. And I think that in a lot of other workplaces, everybody would be frustrated. They'd be like, oh, I can't believe this guy missed another day at work. Oh, I can't believe this person is running late because of a car issue again. But the guys are very patient with each other and compassionate with each other and try to be helpful and pick up the slack and fill in where they can when somebody is missing. Very often, God, people, I don't know if some of your listeners will understand exactly what I'm saying, but I don't know if you know what it is to be black or brown out here in South Central walking around. You get arrested like all the time for nothing. You'll be going onto the train and the cops are like stopping you while you're getting on the train and asking for your ID. My husband was taking the kids out of the car and the cops pulled up and asked him if he had drugs or guns and then tackled him in our driveway and arrested him for resisting arrest. So these things happen all the time. So one of the other reasons why we're constantly missing people at work is because they're being kidnapped by the police.
Wow.
The first thing we do when somebody shows up to work and they haven't called anybody and they haven't notified anybody is to log onto the sheriff's website and see if maybe they got picked up somewhere and when they're going to be released. And very often charges are never brought against them. They just lost a day or two of their lives and probably their job. And then there's a trickle-down effect to that, right? Because if it wasn't us, if it wasn't RCO, if they were working somewhere else and they lost their job, well, what do you lose next? Your housing.
Wow. How can workers have more of a voice than they do now? So many workers get sidelined. So many workers aren't noticed. How can they have more of a voice?
Unionize. I come from a 7-generation union family, and my mother still works for a labor union. However, I have never had a union job. And I think that that's true for a lot of people in my generation who have never worked with a union, been a member of a union, may not have even had a parent who was a union member. That was one of the first things that we did at RCO was to unionize because, you know, they understand that only through their numbers, only through the fact that they actually lubricate this entire economy with our sweat, blood, and our tears, that they can sometimes hold the powers that be hostage. I think that the port is a great example of that, too. I work very closely with the port, and people are always saying, we don't like the union at the port. They hold us hostage. And I'm, you know, well, these are working class people that have control of a very important asset of our economy, and they should use it to demand better lives for ourselves.
You have an economics degree from Columbia and a master's in business, right, from MIT. Did you study this or did you think work is not the way it should be in my city and I'm going to take everything I've learned in these institutions and bring it out to real people?
I think everybody says to themselves at one point in their life that work is not the way it should be.
I would agree with that. Yes.
It's really difficult to break out of a mindset that we've been raised in and educated in and worked in for our entire lives. It's so difficult to step back and try to imagine a different possibility for yourself, one in which nobody in the room is above you or dictating to you, that you're there of your own volition, that you're not being sort of demanded and compelled by money in a way that isn't healthy or natural or fulfilling. I mean, everybody is motivated by money in the sense that we need money to support ourselves and support our families and buy the type of lifestyle that we want. But it's a very different dynamic, I think, when the employer doesn't feel it's their right to demean people, to antagonize people, to demand from people.
That makes so much sense. You want to have some autonomy in what you do every day. How can we make this happen more in our society?
Yeah, it's a question I ask myself every day.
That's Nikki O'Cook, who heads RCO Tires in Los Angeles and hopes someday her workers will vote to buy back their company and take control. And that was Shannon Henry Kleiber talking with her. And that's it for our Labor Day show, but we're going to give the last word to the man who has been our touchstone this hour, the late Studs Terkel, along with steelworkers Ed Sadlowski and Joe Gutierrez.
We're gonna roll, we're gonna roll. this society does not need, no society does not need, you know, a surplus of machine screw operators. We can have machines make machine screws, and let's put men in the areas of where we can, you know, read poetry and play violin. That's what that Rose question is about. Pass that on to your kid. What the hell do I want to pass on machine screw operator to my kid?
Eddie, what's the word you and Joe say as we've had a just easy conversation about labor today and the view of it publicly and scabs once ashamed, now unashamed, and sense of community we're talking about. Well, union means community, of course. So as we go into the two songs, a bit of that early one the Almanac sang, Roll Union On, starring into Bread and Roses Too, a thought perhaps.
Great songs for those issues at the time. But you've got to sing your own song. You've got to write your own song and you've got to sing your own song. It's very difficult to march to someone else's song. And I firmly believe, I really believe, that those songs will be written and those songs will be sang by the very people of this generation, even though they're not hip to it right now. Unfortunately, they will be with the economic situation continuing to develop the way it is.
Oh yeah, all right, hell yeah, that's tight, hey.
Share your song with us at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. Shannon Henry Kleiber produced this hour, with help from Charles Monroe Kane and Mark Rickers. Thanks to the Chicago History Museum and WFMT for archival audio. Joe Hartke is our sound designer and technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm your host, Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.